This podcast is sponsored by Sylphie Reaptress. She makes cave suits. She has made all kinds of things with a sewing machine over the years. She started making leggings, and she's made all kinds of other things since then. And then she started caving, and she was looking for cave suits. And she didn't notice a whole lot to choose from, and so she decided to make her own. And her cave suits are made right. She's been caving long enough to know what you need. You need the real thick stuff, 500 denier cordura, and twice as thick where it counts, the elbows, the butts, the knees, anywhere you need reinforcement. And she does them in a variety of colors. You buy cave suits from elsewhere, they might be nice, but they might come in like two or three different colors. You should look at SophieReaptress.com and see all of the colors you can choose from. Just get a basic suit, or you can get some add-ons like extra pockets, inside pockets, or pockets for your knee pads. Just slip them right in there. Or an extra bat stencil. She does these cool bat stencils. She'll put them anywhere you want them. Everything is made to order just for you at SophieReaptress.com and hit her up on Instagram at SophieReaptress. I've also got the link in the description of this podcast if you want to just click that. Make it easy. Sophie Reaptress, good cave suits. Hi, my name's Matt Pelser, former chairman of the Central Indiana Grotto. I said the word grotto. What's a grotto? That's like a cave club, a local chapter of the National Speleological Society, or NSS. We believe in organized caving because we believe that caving is something that you should do with other experienced people. Even if you're a beginner, as long as you've got other experienced people with you, that's fine. But do not do it with only inexperienced people, and never go alone. There are a bunch of other protocols. And if you join a grotto, you'll find out about them over time. But for now, let's just get started, huh? If you're thinking about going caving, do it the right way. Join your local grotto and or the NSS. I've got a link in the description of this podcast to help you find your local grotto at the NSS website, which is, and this is really easy to remember, caves.org. There you go. This month's guest is Mike Manser, who is the author of The Cave Formation Repair Project, a spiral-bound book full of protocols on the best, most low-impact, leave-no-trace methods for repairing and restoring cave formations. It is such an impressive book, and he has so many volunteers who go out with him every time he goes. And he's done these repairs and restorations in some very high-profile places, as you'll hear in the talk. And Mike is a great communicator for this initiative. So we'll hear from Mike in a little bit. I am still missing a cave suit. It is not a Sophie cave suit, as it turns out. I would be a little more upset if it were my Sophie cave suit, but it is an old meander suit, a black meander suit for a tall guy. And last time I saw it was at Caver's Paradise down in Tag. And I didn't check all my gear before I went home, and somebody either made off with it or I left it there or something. I don't know. But if anyone in Tag or elsewhere has been parading around in a black meander cave suit for a tall guy, and they've had it since May, that might be mine, and I would really love it back. Again, a black meander cave suit, tall. It's mine, and I want it back. Let's see. It's November, so Giving Tuesday is coming up, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. A perfect opportunity, a perfect time of the year for you to give to your local grotto or your local karst conservancy. Here in Indiana, we have the Indiana Karst Conservancy. Of course, there's SCCI. And most of these conservancies or grottos or the NSS, most of them take PayPal to make it easy on you. PayPal or, you know, whatever. Choose your, I don't know, Venmo. Does anybody take Zelle? I'm sure we could work that out to make it super easy. Giving Tuesday. Think about your local caving organizations on Giving Tuesday. Okay, here comes Mike Manser. Again, he's the author of The Cave Formation Repair Project. Thank you, Mike, for sending me the second edition of the book. I think he might be on the third or maybe fourth edition now. I'm not sure. But you can get it at the NSS bookstore online, or you can get it at Spelio Books. You can even get it at the Carlsbad Caverns bookstore there at the National Park. Sells it right there. But it is not on Amazon. He only wants cavers to have it, or, you know, in the case of the Carlsbad Caverns bookstore, anyone who has seen the work and can appreciate it. So if you're interested in beginning an initiative of this on your own, this would be a good resource for you. And just a quick note about the audio quality. He was a little fuzzy coming in, as you'll hear. His mic was a little hot. I thought it sounded fine. Like, I can still understand him. You can still understand him. But just to let you know, it's a little fuzzy. And I tried to do what I could with it. Here is me and Mike Manser. So, Mike, you were just telling me that you're going for a restoration project this weekend?
Yeah, Saturday at the Caverns of Sonoran, Texas. I was called by the one of the people that worked there a few weeks ago and asked me if I could come do a repair on three broken stalagmites that they had matched. So I'm going to be going, leaving tomorrow to go there for working on Saturday. So that's kind of neat.
It seems from the book, The Cave Formation Repair Project, which you can get through Spelio Books, it seems to me like the stalagmites are easier, a little easier.
Oh, yes, 100%, because you've got gravity working for you.
Yeah.
You know, as you saw, the stalactites are a little more technical.
Yeah, a little more technical, which I can't wait to get into. But did you get a sense from talking to the Caverns of Sonora people? And I've talked to a few people. Actually, when I was sponsored by El Spelio, the woman that I gave the headlamp to worked at Caverns of Sonora and met Bill Steele. And got into caving, and so that's why she got the headlamp. And so, yeah, Caverns of Sonora, it seems like a really cool place. Have you been before?
No, but I've actually been asked to repair the butterfly formation that was broken by a visitor, I don't know how long ago, but Lois Mano was contracted to do a replica of the butterfly wing out of glass, and I've been asked to install it. So as soon as that is ready to go, I'll be going back there to do that as well, which is, that'll be a challenge because that's a very delicate formation, as I see.
Well, and that, I don't want to say that goes against the protocol that I've read, but because obviously they want you to do it, and you'll do it if it makes sense. But it seems to me like the protocol for repair and restoration that you go for is the original formation, be it pieces on the ground, and no substitutes.
No, we've never done a substitute before. It's always been the actual pieces. Whether it be a complete formation or partial, we still do the repair of what we find and can match, because once you put a piece together, say a broken piece on top of a stub of a stalagmite, you might find another piece at some point that you can now build on top of that, which has a totally different surface to it. So, but no, everything's totally natural. I've never been asked to do something like this before, so it'll be a challenge.
It'll be different. It won't exactly go against a code. I mean, yeah. You'll still be willing to do it, but it does sound like something that's really, really different. So this is a situation where this was a classic formation. Mm-hmm. And it was broken by a visitor. Gosh, I would hate to have been that visitor. I hope that they feel bad about it.
Yes.
I wonder when it happened. And then it was recreated with glass, you say?
She has a wax mold that she built off looking at a photograph, apparently, and to replicate that one piece of the wing, which is about, looked like 6 inches in length and about maybe 3 feet by 3 inches in height. But the piece isn't, I guess, retrievable. Either it was taken, or otherwise we would try to fix the original piece. So my understanding is that that's gone, and they're trying to replicate it. But this is a commercial cave, so you wouldn't see this happening in Carlsbad Caverns or like a national park, national forest, a BLM caves. They wouldn't do that. It's all totally natural. So commercial caves have a different, I don't know, They run their own thing.
Sure,
so if
sure.
They want to do that, that's cool.
Yeah, I understand that. But it is so cool. Like when before I started looking at the book, I'm like, okay, so maybe he made some repairs to some minor caves and things like that, and sure. You know, developed some protocols and wanted to write a book about that so that other people could maybe know how to do it too. But no, you're in Carlsbad Cavern.
Yeah.
And you're doing this in these amazing places, a national park for one thing. And not just the main cave, but other caves on the property too. And I'm like, okay, no, this is 100% legit. This is not to inspire other people. Well, I mean, it is to inspire other people, but you're the one doing it. And I love it.
Yeah. In fact, the cover of the book is actually a repair we did in Carlsbad Caverns big room, and it was 20 feet off the floor. And it was that was a break that was broken by a visitor's, a young boy that threw a rock at it. And apparently there was a ranger nearby that heard it and several people that witnessed it, but the people took off and left the cave. So I was asked by one of the cave resource people if there was a possibility that I could fix it. Of course, 20 feet in the air, that was a real challenge, but I modified a stalactajack, as you see in the cover of that book, and I used a 2-inch rigid metal conduit, I think it was 13 feet tall, and then put the stalactajack on top of that, and that's what's on the cover of the book. So that was that repair that we did, and it came out really nice. And I think I wrote about it in the book too.
Yeah, you did. And okay, so you dropped a word there that we're going to have to explain: stalactite jack. So part of this restoration that you do, obviously, stalagmites, which we started talking about, that's a little easier. Like you said, you got gravity on your side. You just put some epoxy on there, and if you need to, you core it with some stainless steel or something like that, and then you just set it there, and you wait, and then it cures, and there you go. You got your formation back. With a stalactite, which I'm sure is more common to find broken than a stalagmite, you've got to hold that up. And so what did you do? What is the stalactite jack? How did it first take form? Let's go there.
Okay, so one of the repairs I was asked to do, the first one that was a stalactite, was in a BLM cave. I think it was called Little Manhole. And it was the first, it was, you know, about 3 feet off the ground. And I thought, well, I'm not sure how I'm going to do this. And so I was working on a piece of PVC to just chuck up underneath it. And I was changing the shower curtain in my shower. And that rod has a compressible spring that you can pull together to put the curtain on. And so I got the idea, maybe I could use that to support a formation repair, but you can't cut that. So I thought, maybe I'll get some spring and put it inside of a piece of PVC and make a little piston for it. And that's how it was born. And I just thought of the name right away after I was playing around with it in my workshop. So stalactite jack turned out to be quite a popular thing, which is now in use in Australia and Europe and Slovenia right now.
It's really?
Oh, the book's been sold all over the world, and these people have contacted me telling me they've done repairs and using that book and my device. So it's been, you know, pretty much shared throughout the caving communities and other places.
You have to have been told about any modifications, right? Has anybody ever modified the design or maybe even improved it based on their own circumstances?
No, nobody's come up with it yet, and I've told them I welcome it. I welcome any innovation, and I tell that to all the people that have helped me over the last 5 years. You know, if you come up with a better thing, let me know, and I'll put it in the next edition of my book, because I really regard innovation as a high pillar of the project. So, but I started with a threaded nut to thread it and screw the top of the stalactite jack up. And so I found that was difficult, because when you go to unscrew it, it's been sitting in the cave maybe a month. It may have crust, calcium carbonate crust on it, and then you start impacting the formation. So I came up with a spring after that. It was a threaded rod, and now it's a spring. So for the heavier ones, I use a threaded rod, like the one in Carlsbad Caverns you see on the book cover. But the spring is so easy. You just pull down on the thing, and away you go. It works great. So again, if somebody can improve on that, please tell me, and I'll modify accordingly.
Okay, so just to kind of illustrate what this does is it's a piece of PVC inside a piece of PVC. There's a spring in there. You put like a bolt through one side to hold the spring up, depending on the level of clearance that you need from the floor to the bottom of the stalactite. And then cup holds the bottom of the stalactite in place where you've epoxied the stalactite. Maybe you've cored it with some stainless steel. I don't think that that's always the case, but from reading the book. But then it's held in place for however long it takes for it to cure. Sometimes it's just a day. Sometimes it's in there for weeks, months. And then you go in, you take it down, you hope and pray, and then it stays there. So that's what's going on. And the theme that I kept coming back to as I read the book was he's thought of everything. There are certain tools that were, you know, born out of necessity, like all inventions are, but there were these tools, and not only have you thought of the actual, you know, tools themselves and their function, but you've thought of the materials that need to be used as well, because you can't deal with anything other than stainless steel for metal or aluminum or something like that. And obviously, there are reasons for that. Did you ever run into a situation where you had to make a choice between one thing or another, and you chose the more difficult thing because it was better for the cave?
Yeah, it's definitely stainless steel, because we found, and there was people in the past that were doing formation repairs, Jerry Trout back in the 60s, and he used actually carbon steel nails, which rusted out. So we found several of those in caves like Virgin that just simply disintegrated. So we had to pull them out to put a new stainless steel bolt in. And all I do is take stainless steel bolts, varying size from maybe 1/8 of an inch to 3/8 of an inch, up to 1/2 inch in one case, and cut the head off. And then you just, you usually use that as a rod to put in there. So the threads are a great bonding agent for the epoxy to hold to, but you can't bend that stuff. Even a try bending a 3-inch long, 1/8-inch stainless steel bolt. You see what I mean? And it will corrode. So that's what we use. We don't use anything else. And the PVC is safe for the cave, easy to clean, and one of the recognized things that we can use by the NSS in the cave. So, and usually I have galvanized springs. I've found a few stainless steel springs, but the tension isn't sometimes sufficient, so I have to use galvanized. But again, that really isn't exposed to either dripping or otherwise because it's inside the PVC itself.
Yeah.
But everything stainless steel is what we really would recommend, and I wouldn't change from that.
That's not so much a compromise for sure. And then what I thought immediately when you sort of introduced the process, I thought, how in the world does he get it so that you're drilling in the same spot for this core, for this bolt, this stainless steel bolt in the middle on one side of the formation, maybe the top side, let's say it's a stalactite, on the top side versus the bottom side that's fallen to the ground? How do you get it in the exact same spot with the exact same, I don't know what you would say, direction, if you're going straight up or straight down? How does he do that? And then you explain it later in the book, but could you explain it right now? It was a really cool technique. Yeah, a little crude, but cool.
No, it works really well. So, of course, you do have to have a corresponding hole that lines up with the bottom. Otherwise, the bolt won't line up, and it'll offset the formation. So we just simply drill a pilot hole. And this is something I came up with just standing in Family Dollar one time thinking of how I was going to do this. And I saw Q-tips. And I thought, how can I mark those things with ink? And I thought, oh, no, there was some black fingernail polish there. So I just bought both of those, and we went to a cave and introduced it to the folks that were with me at the time. And we just... it worked very well. You just drill a pilot hole, put the Q-tip down so it's just barely sticking up above the stalactite's base or the stalagmite base, and then put the fingernail polish on it, and then make sure you carefully put the two together so you do have that hole in the right spot. When you take them away, you drill a pilot hole in the upper piece, or depending on what it is, and it left a mark. So it marks clearly where you need to drill on the upper part. And so sometimes they're concave and convex shapes, not a flat break. So we have a Dremel tool that we use that we just developed within the last couple of years with a little grinder on the end so you can make an indent. So when you put the hammer drill bit down onto it, it won't drift off the cone of the crown of the break. And put the two together by marking it that way. It's cheap, and it's easy to do and doesn't impact the cave at all.
So you've done these restorations in New Mexico. We mentioned Carlsbad. You've also done some in South Dakota. Since publishing the second edition of the book, have you been in any other states?
Yep. I went to Lehman Caves in January, and I taught a workshop there of 22 people with two different sessions. And they actually, Kirsten Barr is the cave resource specialist in Timpanogos Cave. She had bought my book, or actually she took my workshop last year at the convention. And so she had my book as a guide and made her own stalactajacks up. So when I came up there, they were already with their own stalactajacks, all made from the book. And so I was able to teach the class and then take these folks into the cave and make repairs there. So that was in Nevada. And also Colorado, I was asked to help out in Cave of the Winds by a man named Dan Sullivan had bought the book from Spelio Books. And made his own stalactajack, but he brought this long formation down to my workshop down here, and we put it together, and then went back up there and installed it in the Cave of the Winds of Colorado. So there we had another state that was involved. In fact, he's doing restorations now based upon the things that he learned in the book. And there also is another cave formation repair project going on from Kirsten in Nevada and Utah. And there's also one in the Pecos Valley Grotto down in Carlsbad. That they have a satellite of this project, too, that they're going into caves and doing their thing. So that's my intent, is to plant the seed and teach the people and let them go out and make these repairs. So I'll be teaching a workshop in Elkins, West Virginia at the convention next month, and that will give the East Coast a new knowledge base, and they'll be starting their own repair projects out there.
Yeah, and you already mentioned Caverns of Sonora, so you'll be moving into Texas soon, too. Yeah.
This weekend, I'll add Texas to that. That's right. That's cool. I love it.
It's sweeping the nation.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so cool. So, all right, let's go back to the beginnings. Well, okay, the very beginning is what, 1986, when you start kind of working, thinking about cave restoration or doing things?
Yeah. So the first, I was living in Vermont. I was born in Vermont, and I was flying out to Carlsbad Caverns for their, it was actually the first, they built it as the first Carlsbad Caverns Restoration Field Camp. And it was a week-long expedition where you had a leader, I think it was Rich Wolfert from Colorado, and we went in the cave every day for 8 hours to do restoration, and I'd never done it before that. And so we dropped pits to clean out the things that were put down in the pits by visitors, and cleaned formations and cleaned algae, and I learned about all that stuff on that 86 trip. So I started coming back every year to do that, and so it just became really interesting. And I was actually the expedition leader in 1996 for that project, but I was also able to take things into Lechuguilla to do restoration there in some cases. And the Guads, which we call the Guads, is the southern New Mexico, is a large forest service area where a lot of caves are. And the High Guads Restoration Project, which at that time, I think it was, I forget who started that back in 99, Dave Diagno, I think, started that. Then it was Susan Herpin, and then finally Jen Foote, who has been doing it for 20 years. But I did a lot of those projects there, too. And it just, it took off because a lot of people that do restoration really like to see something either repaired or restored, cleaned, footprints gone, you know, and trash picked up, trails rebuilt. And that's a lot of the satisfaction of being on these projects. So I just was able to carry that forward to an impact mapping study that I was asked to do in 98 to 2002 in the Guads. And so I made several impact maps over the course of those 4 years to show how much restoration had improved those caves over that period of time. And so I made these colored maps to show the Forest Service. So that was a great reference for them to use as a way of measuring the impact of the restoration. And then, you know, I didn't start the repair process until I was asked in 2018 by Aaron Stockton from the Forest Service to do a repair in Black and Hidden Cave. And so at that point, I didn't know how to really go about doing that. So Jim and Val Hildreth Worker had been doing repairs at that point, and I went down to see them, and they explained to me how to do the drill and how to apply the epoxy and what epoxy to use. So I just took that back and started doing repairs, and I really got hooked. So I started inviting a lot of my caving friends to come down with me and learn how to do this. And it's been, you know, 5 years. I don't think we've missed 1 month, even during the pandemic. We've done at least 2 to 3 trips per month in these caves. And so as a result, now the totals that are in that book that you read are changed. We've now repaired 677 cave formations.
Oh, wow. You got the exact count.
Yeah, I keep track of it. And we've got, let's see how many trips. So we have 98 trips, not counting this week, and it'll be 99. And we've had 124 different people participate. Let's see. And those folks have traveled round trip from home a total of 155,161.5 miles just to participate. So I keep track of this stuff because the Forest Service looks at volunteer value.
Yeah.
And it was a park, too. So I keep track of all this stuff. We write that all down for every trip. So, oh, yeah, and volunteer hours is now up to 3,121.8. volunteer hours that we've done in this project. So
amazing.
It's really, it just keeps going, and it's we do it in BLM, Forest Service, Park Service, and private caves.
All right, so you mentioned Lechuguilla, and when I read in the book that you had done formation repair in Lechuguilla, I'm thinking, who is in Lechuguilla that's breaking formations? What were you repairing there? What were the circumstances, if you're at liberty to say, or even if you know?
You know, actually, that's a restoration project. So doing repairs, there are several places that have broken formations. However, we haven't gone back into repair them, like soda straws and things. No, that's a regulated cave to go into. So you have high-quality folks going in there. Anything that happened there is accidental. And I know there's some shelf stone that we're going to go in there and fix at some point, but I haven't made that decision as to when to do that because we're doing restoration at this point, reflagging. But for the pandemic, I led 5 trips in there doing trail modifications or getting rid of trails, cleaning flowstone, cleaning footprints where people had surveyed off trail and left these footprints and so forth. So we worked on that for 5 different trips. So, but there are several areas I know of that I'm going to have to do a repair on, and I'm just have to put that to the Park Service and let them know that this is my proposal. So everything's set up on proposals.
Gotcha. So another thing that you've been very careful with that I noticed in, you know, reading the book is, again, the theme kept popping up. He's thought of everything. Was the epoxy, the choice of epoxy. What is it about this, what is it, Bueller brand
yes.
epoxy that makes it so safe or so ideal for the situation?
Yes, so that's a product that Jim Worker had done a lot of vetting on. In the old days, I was told they used Elmer's glue, which completely fell apart and degraded in the cave.
Gosh, I would imagine.
And then they tried several other different types of epoxy, but it actually was toxic to the like the cave life, like cave crickets, and they were worried about the bats and so forth. And so then he found this product, which is an archival epoxy that is used in museums. If you've been in a museum and seen like an encased, some places have insects that are encased in this acrylic. This is exactly what this is. It's odorless and colorless when you mix it, and once it's bonded, it's tight and cave safe. So it's a very, very strong product as well. The only thing it doesn't like is moisture. So
that's not good.
So there were several cases where we had tried repairs on dripping formations, stalactites, and it didn't work. And so I came up with a new idea. Having been a climber and using climbing bolts and expansion bolts, I got a hold of this company in New Jersey that had stainless steel anchors, concrete anchors. And so I bought some of those. And so how we fixed the dripping part now, and I think I put that in the last page of the cave book as an appendix. And it explains about how we drill a 3/8 inch hole, the depth of the anchor, and then just simply set the anchor with a little tool that you pound on, and it spreads the fingers out. And then you can thread in a 1/4 inch stainless steel awl thread into it. And so once you've done that, the dripping can continue on through. The corresponding piece, like to say a stalactite, you simply just drill a hole so you know where that's going to line up with the stainless steel pin, and you fill that full of epoxy. You don't even have to put anything on the joint because that's going to get wet anyway. And then once you fill that hole with epoxy for the stainless steel pin to go into, we put a little piece of flagging tape over it just as a temporary umbrella. And just before the epoxy starts to set up, you put the two together and then put the stalactajack underneath it, and that bonds. It doesn't get wet, and it's worked. In some cases, we had a 1 3-foot formation stalactite in cottonwood that held beautifully, one in virgin that was 24 inches long, and several others that we've done, and it's a perfect fix. So now we've solved the problem of wet formations to be repaired, so in a stainless steel.
Well, and the protocol for repairing a formation first is, according to the book, it's cleaning it. So you're wanting to clean both surfaces thoroughly, which I'm sure involves water. How do you then dry it quick enough?
Okay, so I found this. Actually, a friend of mine, Todd Roberts, that has been on many of my trips, came up with this butane heater. It's like a soldering gun, but it just puts out with one particular adapter on it or the tip on it. It just glows like a propane heater. And so once we've washed the formation off, you just use this little heater to dry it. And within 30 seconds, the both faces are dry. And it works like a charm. And
wow.
It's very – yeah, it's a Dremel. It's a product named Dremel. You find it on Amazon, and I think it's about $40, but it's invaluable to dry these things off safely without a flame. I mean, it works perfectly. So we were just using it in virgin 2 weeks ago for the same kind of repair.
Oftentimes when you see broken formations, they're in like a group, you know, there's a bunch of them there. And I would imagine it's frustrating to look at a pile of broken formations on the floor, the cave floor, and then look up and say, okay, well, which one is which?
Yeah.
And you came up with a protocol for that too, which fascinated me. And again, you thought of everything. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. So when you find this cluster of breakage, now sometimes it's spread out over the cave floor. Sometimes it's concentrated in an area where there was a climb down and all the pieces were thrown into that pit. Another part of Cottonwood Cave, the people that went in there and vandalized that threw the formations into a lake, a pool of water, which was 8 feet deep. So we had to develop that little speleo rake. So we speleo fished them out of the pool, and then we, of course, had to dry them all off and then find out where they went. But usually it's very difficult to find the match, you know, because you take the stub, and say, for example, it's a stalactite. So you're walking around with his stub in hand, looking at the ceiling, trying to find something comparable to it. And Todd Roberts came up with an idea to photograph these in color and to scale with a little ruler that we ended up calling it photo image matching. And so then he put those photographs onto a sheet of paper, numbered everything, and numbered the formations, say 1 to 10 or 1 to 20. We put 20 on it each page. And then you take this piece of photographic paper, and now you have 20 images in color to scale to hold up and look around. So it's a lot lighter than the formation in your hand, and you can look at 20 comparably at one time. So, I mean, that was a very clever idea. We've used that now in most of the caves, and it extremely well. So it's photo image matching.
Yeah, improves the efficiency, I'm sure, and lowers the frustration a great deal, I would imagine.
Yeah, being in your neck, looking up all the time.
Well, looking up, then looking down, looking up, looking down. All right, I found one. Let's find the mate. All right, that's not it. I can't find it. You know, I just couldn't imagine.
Oh, it's sometimes frustrating, very frustrating. But this helps it a lot.
So you mentioned the impact mapping, which, you know, it's something as a wreck caver like I am, I haven't really thought of. And of course, if you're talking about restoration or repairs and things like that, it only made sense that this would be a thing that you did. Can you kind of talk about the process of, going into a cave, finding the place and doing the impact map, just sort of a Cliff Notes version?
Yeah. So the original one that I had done back in the 98, 99 and 2000, I simply photographed areas, assessed them versus a pristine or moderately impacted, heavy impacted, destroyed. And then I kind of came up with a color scheme, like red was destroyed and blue and yellow, and I think it was green was pristine. And so I used that to make a map. And so I took that same process, which I wrote a paper, actually, that's in the book. It talked about that to the NSS News back in, 2000, I think it was.
Yeah, it's in the appendix. I loved that. It really perfectly illustrated it.
Yep. And so now what we did for the broken formations is we just simply either, if we have to make a map or a sketch of the cave, we can't get a hold of the cartographer's map, then I just simply quickly do a survey, draw it, and then I can put in where all the different broken formations are in the ceiling and floor. And then after we fix them, just draw a green circle around it. So you have red dots is the breakage, and then the green circle shows where it's been repaired. So this is a very nice tool to give to the Forest Service, Park Service, and BLM to show them this is what we have done. We build on that every trip. So I have a map, impact map of every cave that we've been in, and I just present that to the government or the private landowner. To show them what we have done. And it's a very effective way because the green dots really show up. That's in the book too, I believe.
You've got to analyze what you're going into or what you're coming out of. And I mean, this is a comprehensive way to do it. And I applaud that. So, I mean, you go through all of the tools and how to make them and things like that. And there are some unique ones. When I saw this elephant's foot, am I saying it right?
Yes.
When I saw the elephant's foot, I thought, well, that's an ugly formation, but it is a formation, and you wanted to repair it. It looked like it had been sitting on the ground for a long time.
Yes.
How would you characterize that formation? I couldn't even tell you what it is.
It's really a curtain.
It's a curtain?
It's the end of a curtain, yeah. It's quite thick and very unique. I mean, it's actually a stalactite, but it was more of a curtain, too. And how that came about is, I think it was Todd also was sitting on the floor doing another repair, and he saw where people had stepped on this. I've been going in Hidden Cave for probably 30 years, and stepped on this same thing. And he happened to look at the shape of it and look at the ceiling, and it was right above there where it went. And so I let him name it, so we call it the elephant's foot. Well, Jennifer Foote, our cave resource specialist down there now, I thought in tribute to her I would just spell it F-O-O-T-E, like her last name. Okay. So that's where that comes about. But it was Hunter Klein and Michael Moffitt that actually – we were in there trying to fix the piece. And so we cleaned it all off, but all we had was one stalactajack down there and a speleo clamp. And the stalactajack wasn't enough to hold this weird shape. And so I said, guys, I value innovation. Find out, see if you can come up with something to fix that. And so it just happened to be that the piston for the stalactajack is a half-inch PVC. And one of the T that's on the corresponding speedio clamp was a half-inch T. And so they put the two together and clamped it, and there it was. And so I think that's in the book as well. But I let them name it, so they called it Speedio Crutch or Splatter Crutch. I can't remember what it was, but it was very clever, and that was a very unique formation to fix, because I had to put I think I used a 3/8-inch stainless steel rod just to hold that together, because it's right next to the trail, and it weighed, I'm guessing, close to 15 pounds. So, but it was rather unique. A lot of people had their hands in fixing that, either cleaning it off or camouflaging the joint. It was fun.
Oh, forgive me, I might have missed this. You said you've been going to that cave for a long time. Was there a point when you remember seeing that in its natural form, like where it was, or has it always just been sitting on the ground?
It's always been sitting on the ground.
Okay, so it's been broken off since time immemorial, I guess.
Yeah. In fact, I started going in that cave and hidden back in the early 90s. And, of course, I'm sure I stepped on that thing because there's a little pool right there and, and some mud and stuff. And it took somebody else to come in there for the first time with a different set of eyes and recognize that that's where it went. But we'd already been doing formation repairs in that cave for a couple of years. And so it was just wonderful to see, oh, look at this, a mash. And to be able to repair it was even more extraordinary, but it was fun.
Was it a perfect match? Like, did it fit on there perfectly?
Yep.
And it wasn't, so it wasn't like corroded, but it wasn't worn somehow from traffic or anything to where, you know, it wouldn't have fit perfectly. Wow. That's amazing.
It fell in the mud, I think, and that's what saved it. It was in a cushion of mud. And so stepping on the top of the side of it, actually, when it was laying sideways, didn't impact it at all, because it did have a good fit together. And, we did have some new growth that was on the surface of the base where it came from. And so we had to use the Dremel tool to kind of clean that off so it would fit better. But it worked out quite well. And what a uniquely shaped thing that was.
Yeah, I've never seen anything quite like it. I mean, with it in place, it's kind of easy to tell that it had been broken at one time. The color match, I mean, were you able to get the color match just right, or had it been sitting on the ground way too long and it just would not work?
It was tough because it was stained pretty badly. I know Michael Moffitt was scrubbing on that quite a while. Him and I think John Cochran was helping him clean that up before we actually did the repair. And it just, you couldn't get all of it out. It was just the white, as you see in the photograph, the base of it's all white. So what we did is we used the drill powder to kind of make a little paste and just water paste and just kind of paint it a little bit. So it lightened it up some, but unfortunately, there's no way to clean the you can't get into the pores of the rock that well, you know, the calcium carbonate. So it was just, it's very obvious that it's been repaired, even though we lightened it up quite a bit with the paste.
I want to come back to the subject of heavy formations. The stalactajack, as you said, in its, in its original form, it seems like it was the threaded, right? But then you modified it to the, the original form is the one that's kind of stronger, maybe for heavier formations.
Yep. In fact, I've actually brought the two together. So the spring loaded, the piston that goes up and down in the normal stalactajack that we use now, I actually made a hole in a 1/2-inch cap and set that threaded rod down in there with a ring nut on it. So I can adjust the height, you know, if it needs to be adjusted 1 inch or 2 inches, and it still has the spring tension, but the top where it touches the formation is got a threaded rod there. I mean, it has a cap too, but at least you can adjust it a little bit. And so it works quite well because you can adjust the height without having to pull the spring out and drop the spring down a little bit. So that does work. But no, for heavier formations, like the one on the cover of the book, that weighed, 32 pounds, I think it was. And
it's way high up off the ground too.
Yeah, 19 feet in the air was the base of it. Whew. And but that's where that big tall stalactajack was used, and it worked really quite well. But that was a 3/4-inch threaded rod that I had with a 3/4-inch nut, of course, and a spring loaded wouldn't have worked. We couldn't have retracted the spring enough with that kind of weight and had it worked. So it was just something we had to use the wrench. In fact, I think Minori on the cover of the book has got the wrench in her hand when we went up the ladder to torque that nut.
But I can imagine. You know, the practicality of the modified version with the spring just makes so much more sense. It's so much quicker. But again, it doesn't work on everything, and I totally get that.
Nope.
So these formations like that one that are in high-profile areas, in that case Carlsbad, have you ever had a situation where one of the repairs failed?
Oh, not come apart. Only when the epoxy, when he pulled the slack jack off, epoxy didn't hold like the wet conditions. But normally it holds well, and nothing, we've never gone back and found one that's fallen that we've done. It's, if it's bonded, it's got 3,000 PSI, so the epoxy does. So if it's set well, then that works. I know, and think, too, the heaviest one I wanted to mention that we did was in Spider Cave. That weighed 54.45 pounds. And that we used that threaded stalactajack on, too. And it actually bent the PVC, which was an inch and a quarter PVC, as we put underneath the thing. So that required the Spedio crane. That's how we got the thing in place.
Oh,
so,
the crane.
Yeah. That's what I made that one for. I couldn't use a step stool because righteously so, the government said you can't guarantee that the step ladder is going to hold the weight of the person and the formation safely. So I thought, well, okay, maybe I can lift it into place. So I'm a great PVC guy, so I made this device called a Spedio crane. It's all stainless steel, and it has a crank and a rope, and we lifted that piece up into place. And the reason we know how much it weighs is I bought a fish scale that I can use to simply lift on a formation and weigh it. And that's how we found out that piece weighed that much. And that's in the book as well. But that was the heaviest stalactite that we repaired to date.
Whew. My goodness. In the book, you talk about the work that you did in Cottonwood Cave, an awful lot of formations repaired in there, according to the book. And I have the second edition. It says 254 formations repaired over 30 trips.
Yeah.
And you named the first 10,
yeah.
which I thought was cute.
I was doing that. Actually, Aaron Stockton brought me in the cave after I'd done some other repairs and hidden in black, and he said, well, some people have already tried to match these up, you know, and so he said we have names on them, and I thought, well, that's pretty clever. The only problem is we ran out of names after a couple of years, so we had to change it over to numbers. But that was cute because people were creative with the names. I mean, I can't remember some of the ones, but they were really, I mean, out there. And it's just I let people, you know, you find it match, you name it. And that was clever till we ran out of names. We were going in like Sally 2 and Charlie 2 or something like that. So we decided to change it to numbers. But no, it was an effective way at first if you don't have a lot of broken formations to at least identify where they go.
it was fun. And then in this cave, and it's probably my lack of experience, but in this cave, there's a formation that you refer to as a lion's tail, and I'd not heard of that kind of formation, though I've seen them myself. And that one just looked like it would have been super challenging because it's this heavy bottom of a stalactite that's all knobby and weird, but it looks very heavy. What did you have to do for that one?
Okay, so that one was tough because that's usually, as we think, they're formed underwater where there was actually a soda straw or a stalactite that when the pool level below it rose up around it, it gave these little pieces of crust sticking off or popcorn-like surfaces something to grow on. And so that one was, I forgot the length of that, it was probably 14, 15 inches long, but you're right, it was heavy at the bottom. And so I didn't have a cup big enough on the stalactajacks to actually make it work. And I think I used a threaded one on that one too. But to drill the hole for the stainless steel pin, because it needed to have some structural integrity as far as the joint, because you only had like an inch diameter stalactite that it came from, the base, and you had the bottom was like 4 inches in diameter. So it had to have a stainless steel pin in there. So drilling the pin, I think Scott Christensen was with me on that one, and we managed to put the pin in the thing and then matched the two pieces, and it was dry, so the epoxy worked well. But stalactajack had to be very cleverly turned in place with that nut on the thrall thread because it was a kind of an unstable surface where the stalactajack was setting in the pool below on kind of a dirty surface. So, but we left that in place, I think, for a month just to make sure that thing would bond. But, yeah, it worked. But the lion's tail, those are tricky, but we found out how to do it. I mean, just simply pilot, you know, find your way and try something different, but it worked like a charm, and it's still there today, of course.
Necessity is the mother of invention, for sure.
Yep.
Another unique formation, same cave, that I'm sure you've got a lot more of out in the Southwest than we do here in the Midwest, a coke table. Probably kind of forms, I wouldn't say in a similar way to the lion's tail, but sort of the same circumstances where there was a water level at one time and then the water recedes over time and you've got these formations left, what looks like a flat top, so the top of the water level and this calcite around it, but then this crazy formation below it. And this thing broke off. And again, this is kind of like a stalagmite in that you've got gravity working with you. But, you know, you took it upon yourself to fix this one, too, kind of in a similar way. But it seems like it might be a little brittle on the bottom. What did you do to make sure that you weren't damaging part of the formation on the bottom there? Because it looked like that could be really, really, I don't know, fragile.
It was very fragile. And so, but it was so top heavy, you know, that we had to use, I think I ended up using a stainless steel rod of like three eighths of an inch diameter and 8 inches long. But we were able to drill down into the floor where in the bottom of the pool where it came from. Thank goodness it was the base of a stalagmite. Sometimes coke tables are formed from soda straws from the ceiling, and when the water comes up around them, it forms the same shape, but there's no base. This one had a base, thank goodness. So we were able to drill down, and drilling up into the piece was, we couldn't mark it. I forgot how. I think we stuck a Q-tip in place just to kind of line for the drill, for the impact drill to go. But we experimented with a smaller diameter bit a couple times and then just went to the larger one, to the 3/8. But it had to be a strong piece because it's in a traveled area of that room. And so now it's got a 3/8 inch rod, stainless steel rod, that you can't break it. And but putting it together was really tricky because it was pretty – it had a lot of those popcorny pieces on the bottom of the piece that we actually repaired. So that was challenging. In fact, I think it was Foz Trotner that helped me on that one. And I let him do the drilling on it because I wanted people to have experience on this. But that was one of the only ones we've ever done. I think we did two of those coke tables in that room. And that's it. Nowhere else.
Hmm. I wasn't aware of the visitation history of Fort Stanton Cave. Like I only know Fort Stanton Cave from the recent exploration efforts, more recent, you know, within the last, I don't know, 10, 20 years, whatever it is. But I guess that was heavily visited and heavily vandalized in the early 20th century. And you went back and fixed some of those.
Yeah, yeah. As a matter of fact, the fort apparently was built or commissioned in 1855, and we found several signatures with the date 1855 in there.
Wow.
So that's right near where we're working. But somebody had definitely taken a tool, either a sledgehammer or a chisel, to many of those formations, and I'm pretty sure I put that in the book, showing where the chisel marks are. And so in many cases, we had to assemble the pieces and put them back together, but we couldn't change the chisel marks. And case specialist New Peterson said, no, leave the chisel marks as is so we can show folks that what had happened. But we put together some that had 6 or 8 pieces to them, the base that was broken.
Wow.
But it was deliberately done, completely deliberately done. And I don't know how many dozens of them in there we fixed. Probably close to 36 we did repairs in that room, and many – were that we matched up using that method I talked about before, the photo image matching, but the pieces had been broken probably 150 years or thereabouts, but we were able to match some. We're still working in that room today and finding matches, but there was a variety of things. There's shelf stone that we fixed there, and crust, and stalagmites, and soda straws, and stalactites. I think we had a couple pieces of bacon that we actually fixed that came down the side of a wall. And but to think that it was deliberately done by somebody, I mean, who would carry, and this is about an hour into the cave, who's going to carry whatever type of light they had back then and a sledgehammer and just go in and just destroy something that far in the cave? And it's probably one of the only decorated areas of that historic section in the lake room. And it's just amazing that somebody would deliberately do that on so many formations. It's like somebody had something against whoever owned the cave. I mean, why would you go do that? Because they had multiple whacks on some of these formations. In fact, one of them was a stalagmite that we found 2 pieces to make it complete. And I think it was 10 inches diameter. How the devil would you break that off? I mean, and the pieces went down into a pit in some cases. So we had to retrieve them out of the pit. But that was a heavily impacted part of the cave that we're still working on today.
Just amazing that you were able to find matches at all, considering how long they'd been there, how much they'd probably been kicked around over the years. I mean, it just, I just the level of patience and dedication is really admirable. So I come now to Pink Dragon Cave, where it seems like you showed up and you found some formations that had been repaired that had then failed later for various reasons.
Yep. So I'm not sure who actually attempted to fix those, but I know that we went in a lot of cases. There was epoxy that had run down the side of the a stalagmite. And so we used a Dremel tool to clean those areas up and camouflage the joints. But a lot of them had actually, there was a couple stalactites that had failed, and some other ones that we found matches to that had epoxy on them, but there was no base. No, they were just laying there repaired. And so we, in the last two or three trips, we matched quite a few of those, found some that were in some of the pools there that we matched up. And so I forgot how many repaired in there. I think we repaired probably 26 or 7 formations, including one that's 4 feet long that right now has a special stalactajack underneath it. And we'll be going back in the fall when it opens up again to pull the stalactajack down. But people tried to fix things, and sometimes it doesn't work out well, but you know, we've developed these new ways of concealing the joints and using mud paste, or in some cases I'll mix a little bit of mortar with it, just if it needs to fill in a spot that the crust is missing. But most of the time we use mud or drill powder. But yeah, a lot of those had been attempted to be prepared before, I don't know how long ago.
The Slaughter Canyon Cave formation.
Oh, yeah.
I saw this thing and I'm like, how in the world? How in the world? So can you describe the formation and how you then ended up fixing it?
Yeah, so Erin Lynch had contacted me. She's the physical sciences specialist at the Carlsbad Caverns National Park, and told me that there was a very strange formation that they'd like to see fixed because it goes right next to the trail. And she showed me the pieces in a photograph, and so, okay, so that's always a challenge. So we went up there, and I was ready for anything. And this was a very strangely shaped formation. It was top heavy. It leaned to the left about maybe 8 degrees to the side. And so it was like pancakes on top of each other. But somebody had tried to repair it in the past with I think it was an 1/8-inch stainless steel piece of metal. And of course it wouldn't hold that. The whole thing had collapsed and fallen into a dry pool. And so the two pieces, each one weighed probably 60 pounds each. I didn't bring my scale up there to weigh them, but they had previously had a little thin piece of stainless steel wire. I'm still baffled as to why they would try that, but we ended up just pulling the wire out of the place that it wasn't in the formation and drilling a 3/8-inch hole 4 inches deep in the top and bottom of each joint and put a stainless steel rod in there. And that right there, you couldn't move it. Once we put them together before we epoxied them, it held well. So once we put the epoxy on, you know, we came back a month later and it worked like a charm. So that's not going to go anywhere. I'm sure they could even kick that. Somebody could and not. It won't go.
But don't do it. Don't do it.
No. I'm just saying if they abruptly fall into it, you know, or walking by it because it's right on the trail.
Yeah.
But of course, that trail is led by or open for people. It has to be ranger led and has a big gate so the rangers can go and, you know, supervise any activity going in the cave. But at least that the repair is going to hold. I'm very confident of that because stainless steel rod that's 8 inches long, 3/8-inch thick, try to bend that. We couldn't even cut it with a pair of bolt cutters. We have a foot long bolt cutters. I had to use a 2 foot long bolt cutter to snip that in half.
Wow.
And, but it'll stay. So I'm rather confident in our repairs there, but that was a challenge, a really strange one.
Is that the heaviest you've done?
No, actually get to the lake cave. And that's another one that Erin had contacted me about and said that there's a lot of damage up in this lake cave, which is, it's like a 3.5-mile hike just up in the back of the canyon there to get to. And so we've been going there, I think, three or four trips now. But the last trip we went in, it was John Cochran that was with us, a long-time caving friend of mine. And we'd walk by this broken, it's like a large stalagmite or rock or whatever. Anyway, the piece was laying next to it, and we were more concentrated on finding broken formation repairs, which we found a lot of inside in Turdu. He said, this piece matches. And so, my goodness, we walked right by it, and it's like 2 feet in diameter and about maybe a couple feet tall. And so I said, let me see how much this thing weighs. So I had the fish scale, which is rated for 110 pounds. So I went above it, and I started to pick up on the thing like a deadlift, and the doggone hook on the thing failed. So it weighed more than 110 pounds.
Oh, my gosh.
But it was Emily Brent that brought in some webbing, and so we managed to sling a webbing around the thing, and three of us team lifted it up into place.
Wow.
And we didn't need to use a pin on that one. It just weighed too much. So gravity held it in place. So we epoxied it, camouflaged the joint. And of course, that's not in the book yet. This just happened recently.
Right, so right.
It'll be in the next edition. But that was the heaviest. So I'm going to say that's 110 plus. That's probably the heaviest one we did, but it matched perfectly.
Yeah. Right, well, that's good.
But yeah, we had walked by it, but it takes another pair of eyes that hadn't been in the cave before to say, oh, wait a minute, this fits. That's fun.
I can imagine that sort of on-site training is kind of the best way to demonstrate how to do this sort of thing. But you, despite that, you made a training alcove, or was it you? Is it somebody else?
Yes. No, it was me. I made this little structure that's, I called it the grotto, and it's 4 feet wide, 2 feet deep, and 6 feet high. And so I wanted to make some, I'm a wood turner too, so I made formations out of wood that I cut a break into them. And so now I could show people at a workshop how to use the stalactajacks so they don't have to go into the real cave and not know how to use these devices, you know, and not hurt anything. So I used that at the NSS convention last year, and I've taken it around to different grottos to show people how it works. And so now, I don't know if you're aware, but the Park Service has now set up a volunteer exhibit using that display with a plastic case over it in the visitor center. So it's going to be there for their centennial year. So anybody that wants to go see that device that I made, it has stalactajacks in it, speedo clamp. It's got, I think it's got the curtain repair, the horseshoe shaped device, soda straw clip. All that's inside that device that I built, and it's now in the visitor center at Carlsbad Caverns. So you get to read about how this all works. And plus, there's a glass display showing all of our tools. I think they've got my book in there too, as to showing how the one in the big room was done. But no, I made that just so I could train people. And so now that that's in their possession for a year, I had to make another small one I can take to convention this year. So, but that's to train people how to use the stalactajack and speedo clamp and the speedo rack. All these different devices are in that to show people how the visitors how that we do this stuff.
The book is so comprehensive and so impressive, and you know, whatever edition is available, you should get it if you're interested in doing this kind of repair. I want to close with a few questions about your personal caving history. When did caving start for you?
1968. My father took my sister and me into a cave in Vermont. I forgot, it was in Arlington, I think it was, and I was kind of hooked because I was always... I actually had bought a book called The Diamond Cave Mystery when I was young, and I must have read that a dozen times. It all took place in Carlsbad near there. It was I don't even remember where the book ever went, but I loved that book. But it described these folks going through caves and so forth, and then my father was always talking about, jeepers, you know, Carlsbad Caverns looks like a beautiful place to go and see all these nice things. So I started buying literature based on that right around the late 60s and bought my first helmet, hard hat for carbide light back then. Well, I remember I was working in a store bagging groceries and I saved up my money to buy this hat. I ended up retiring that hat in 2018, so it was 50 years old. And
wow.
I went with a new Petzl. So I have a Petzl now I've been using since then. But
they don't make them like they used to.
No, it was aluminum, but it was a bright blue. And mostly photographs you'll see of me back before that time will have that hat on. But no, I started there and caving in Vermont, and there's a lot of beautiful caves in Vermont that are in marble. And then I started in 1986, of course, coming out here, and the rest is kind of history, as they say.
Yeah. So project caving for you or wreck caving, what would you say was your main focus?
Mostly project caving since that time, except for Lechuguilla. So we were doing climbing and cartography. Mostly in the Far East, I was going back there too, but I was having fun surveying and exploring, and then I got involved in mineral inventories and then some restoration, and then actually we did a helium study where the late Kim Cunningham had released some helium in the western borehole to see if different parts of the cave, the airflow would bring it to these points, and so I was in the Far East for that trip and collecting air samples every 4 hours for several days in these special cylinders that they'd given us. But the theory was that there may be a connection between that and Big Manhole Cave, so for the airflow. And I think it was something to do with drilling back then for oil nearby, and they wanted to show that, wait a minute, you know, this is going to impact environmentally a lot of things. So that was another project I worked on. And so mostly project caving. I haven't done any recreational trips except maybe I went to Sentinel Cave a couple years ago before the pandemic just as a fun trip. That's a that you just go into, and it's got about 950 feet of rope you have to go through to get to the back of the cave. But that's the only rec trip I've done basically in the last 5 years because this project has been taking up so much of my time. And I'm just, you know, I've got a waiting list for every trip for people that want to be on it. So, you know, I'll keep doing this as long as I can.
That's so encouraging that there's so much interest in doing this kind of conservation and repair and restoration work. That's great. You must feel wonderful about that.
I do. In fact, I forgot to add, too, the Aggie Grotto from the Texas A&M had contacted me about getting my book, and also they want to start a project there, too. So there is a Texas grotto that is wanting to do repairs out on that side of the state. I forgot about that. But, no, they've booked most of the trips this summer with me to come and participate. So that's a great thing. It was Jenna Crabtree, I think, is the grotto chair. And but, no, it's about 20 folks from there that are coming to different trips. But, no, it's so much fun to share this stuff because I just know that when I'm not here anymore, at least I may have planted a seed and got some interest going because caves need that kind of protection. I mean, they need to be rehabilitated or repaired or restored. And, you know, most people want to go in just for the fun of recreational caving. But I'm trying to inspire a lot of the younger folks, which many of them are college age that are coming on these trips, that are really jazzed about doing these repairs. And so I'm so excited to see that. And I just, you know, I'm sure it'll keep on going and keep expanding as we go.
Have you ever finished a project? Like, have you ever gone to a certain area and then done everything you could and, you know, looked all around, did everything, and then left? Like, you've said, all right, that part's done.
Yep. Well, so far, no, except I was going to do that with Virgin a couple trips ago because we'd done everything we could do in the entry areas where we were working. But way in the back of the cave is this room called Lake Room. And so there was this broken stalagmite, 3 inches in diameter, about 18 inches tall, that accessed an area that's close to the cave. It was right there by the lake. And it was on flowstone. And I'd been gone by that thing for probably 30 years and never gave it a thought. Even when I was doing repairs, I usually take people back there as a reward trip for helping out on the project just to see the pretties. And so the 2 trips ago, I had some Colorado cavers and Kirsten from Tipinogos came down. So I had these new sets of eyes back there. And I think it was Joe looked in the pool and saw this piece of a formation, a stub or a section. And he says, that looks like it belongs on this stalagmite over here. I said, really? So I said, go ahead and fish it out. So he took it out. And then it wasn't 10 minutes later that I think it was Kirsten and maybe Layla found 2 more pieces to complete this formation. This made it 34 inches tall. Complete. And so we went back this last trip and we made the repairs. And so we had some new folks from Colorado there too. And I let them do the repair themselves as far as the guide. I gave them some guidance on the drilling. And now that's the complete formation. So that's going to end up in the next issue of the book, I guarantee you, because it's a really very visible repair. And all of us had walked by it except for the new folks that came in. So I was going to close that part of the Virgin down. I thought, well, you know, we're done. And now I think we found 4 or 5 more matches just in that area already. And I was going to close it down. So now it's probably another 5 trips down there.
Yeah, the work is never done, I'm sure. Well, it's such a cool initiative. It's so important. And your passion for it comes through in the communication. And I'm sure that that's what's motivating all of these people to keep coming back with you every time. Which, again, I'm sure you're thankful for, but I'm thankful to them as well. Just amazing, Mike. Amazing. And thank you for the book, and thanks for your time today.
Well, thank you, Matt, too. It's been fun talking about this, and I appreciate that. And anybody that's listening, I want to thank all the people that have been involved with this project to say that their inspiration is great, their innovation, their ideas, well welcomed. And anytime anybody wants to come, just get a hold of me, and I'll arrange a trip.
The book is available from Spelio Books. It's called The Cave Formation Repair Project. The author is Mike Manser. Mike, thanks again.
Thank you, Matt.
And wasn't that cool? I'll say it again. He has thought of everything. The Cave Formation Repair Project, Spelio Books, NSS Bookstore, Carlsbad Caverns Bookstore. Get it. Make it happen if you think that this sounds like something you would be interested in doing. I encourage it. Mike encourages it. Support this podcast by supporting our sponsors, past and present. Get a Swago pack at swagogear.com. Fundraise for your grotto with t-shirts made by Organic Robot Designs in Greenfield, Indiana. Charlie Vetter's former chairman of the CIG, My Grotto, the Central Indiana Grotto. He's got a t-shirt shop, screen printing business. It's really, really cool. He does incredible original designs, but he'll put whatever you want on a t-shirt, and then you can sell them, make a little money for your grotto. Organic Robot Designs, just Google that. You'll find it. And also, El Spelio, now being sold by On Rope One, my preferred light. It's the light on my helmet. And, of course, Sophie Reaptress at sophiereaptress.com for the best cave suits out there. Link in the description. Is that everything? Oh, next month, Jessica Jernigan. This is another one of those ones I've been sitting on for a while, like the Mike Manser one. I recorded that one back in the spring. I think I talked to Jessica last winter, and surely she has done an awful lot since then that obviously we don't talk about in the interview, but, man, she had done an awful lot up to that point. And it was a really cool talk. I can't wait for you to hear it on December the 1st. Again, think about your grotto or your local Karst Conservancy or the NSS on Giving Tuesday. And my name is Matt Pelser of the Central Indiana Grotto. Until next time, kill nothing but time.